systems practicing, they have to use this criterion to distinguish between those people who are in fact practicing Islam as it was revealed, and those people who are practicing cultural traditions which in fact have nothing to do with Islam. Question, why is alcohol prohibited in Islam? Now, the Prophet Muhammad has said, Al-Khamru Ummul Khaba'ith, that alcohol is the mother of filth, corruption. This is telling us fundamentally why it is prohibited. Because it produces corruption in the society. When we look at the crimes which are committed, we find that people oftentimes commit these crimes in states of intoxication. People get intoxicated to loosen themselves up. I know before Islam, you know, when we used to go to parties, everybody would feel they had to have some drinks so that they could get loose. In other words, what happens is that you now have the courage to do things that you wouldn't do if you weren't intoxicated. And this is why you find many of the grossest of the crimes, these are committed under times of intoxication. We find, for example, where people are involved in car accidents. The vast majority of the car accidents which take place, for example, in America, they take place as a result of drunken driving. How many people are maimed and killed on the roads because of drunken driving? So we see that there is harm to the society as a whole. Also, people who drink, you know, a lot, we find medical profession have shown what happens to their liver. They get sclerosis of the liver. They can affect their brain. You know, it affects their physical systems. It breaks it down. It is physically harmful. I know some people will say, I only drink a little bit. I never get drunk. Why are you going to prohibit me from drinking? Well, Islam does recognize that there are a few people who will only take sufficient quantities which will not in any way impair their judgment. It will only make them feel a little nice, a little warm or whatever. And they stop at that point. You have a few people like that, but there are few. So Islam, again, when we talk about human welfare, if we see that alcohol is something which harms the vast majority of people, but a few people from among the people benefit from it, what do we do? Do we say it's okay for the benefit of the few, or do we prohibit it to protect the majority? Islam says prohibit it to protect the majority. Because if we were to put the condition that those may drink only who will not get intoxicated, everybody is going to say, I won't get intoxicated. Who is going to say, I will get intoxicated and so I won't drink? Very few people. There again, few. So because very few people will admit that they will get intoxicated when they drink, Islam has to stop it for everybody to protect the society as a whole, as well as the individuals who are not able to control their habits. Question. I am a converted Muslim. My family is not. What should I do? Well, it is your duty to call them to Islam. Allah has blessed you with guidance in your life. It is your duty to pass that guidance on to others in the hope that Allah will also guide them. So it is an obligation on you to call them to Islam. If your wife is a Christian, you are allowed to remain married to her because Islam allows a Muslim male to marry a Christian or Jewish female. If she is Buddhist or Hindu, then the marriage is dissolved, unless she accepts Islam. But in the case of a Christian or a Jew, the marriage can continue. But of course, as a Muslim, you are obliged to set down certain principles in your household. And this is why Islam allows the male to remain married to the female. But if a female accepts Islam, then she cannot remain married to a male Christian or a Jew. Why? Because the male lays down the law in the home. So if she accepts Islam and he says, I want you to cook me some pork, go down the store, buy me some alcohol, I want to have a party, I want to dance with this man's wife, and I want him to dance with you. You know, the woman, she is obliged to do what he wants her to do. So she will be forced to do many crimes against Islam, against herself and against Islam. Whereas, as a Muslim, male, whatever laws are laid down in the home, that's for the benefit of the home. If he says no alcohol in the home, that's to help the home. It's to protect the home. If he says, you know, no parties, you know, if we have parties, it's limited scale. You know, you can invite your female friends over, you have a female party, but getting up and dancing and me with another man's wife, and you go dancing with another man, no, none of this. Because why? Because this leads to corruption. So these types of things, you tell your wife, listen, you have to now, you're my wife now, you're Christian, I'm not going to force you to be Muslim, but no more miniskirts. You can't go out, you know, with your body half exposed. No, this is for her benefit. But the non-Muslim man, he's going to be telling the Muslim woman, no, I want this man friend. This is covering yourself up. No, you know, I want to be proud of you. So I want you to wear this short dress exposing yourself. So she is now being forced to do things which are in fact harmful. So Islam allows that male to continue to be married to a female who is a Christian, and he is still encouraged to lay down the law within the home and to continue to encourage her to come to Islam. But he doesn't have to force her. But if he finds that, you know, she in fact is not complying with what he has, you know, set down in the home, and he is undermining Islam in the home, for example, he wants to raise his children as Muslims, and she wants to take them to the church and, you know, to continue to try to keep them involved in Christianity, he may be obliged then to dissolve the marriage, because the marriage should be Islamic fundamentally. Even though she may not be a Muslim, the fundamental principles involved in the marriage should be Islamic, and the children should be raised as Muslims. So I would say that person is encouraged, obliged to call the rest of his family to Islam if it involves his wife. He may continue to be married to her if she's not a Muslim, if she's Christian or Jew. His parents, he should encourage them, but of course he should also take into account, you know, their age and the attitudes of the elders to the youngers. So they should not try to push Islam down their throat. They should try to introduce it gradually, you know, with reason. They should also show it in his behavior. You see, because if he comes back as a Muslim, and in fact he is coarser, harsher, rougher with his parents than he was, then they're going to say that Islam doesn't produce a good thing. It produces a terrible product. Whereas if he comes back and he's kind, he's gentle, Islam actually has affected him, so he treats his family in ways that they never expected, then this can have a greater effect than any words that may be said. So the best method of calling people to Islam, especially your family, is your own example. Applying Islam in your own life so that you will be a living example of what Islam can do for man. You know. Question, why females in Islam are told to be covered and not nailed? This question is not quite true. Males are told to be covered too. I mean, men are not told to be said it's okay to walk around naked. You know, no. They're told to be covered too. But it's only that, you see, there is a difference in the physical makeup of the male and the female. So the part that is required of the male to cover is not the same as that of the female. Because if you're going to say it's the same for the male and the female, then you're implying that physically speaking they're the same, when in fact they are not. So Islam takes into account that the woman has more attractive parts than the man. So more is required to be covered. But the man is also required to be covered. And this is a principle which actually a lot of people are not clear on, because emphasis is not placed on it. In the case, for example, of males, what is required for them to cover is between the navel and the knee. Between the navel and the knee. Specifically, the area of the private part. Now, covering in Islam means not merely having material over this area. It means covering in such a way that this area is not described. Because if the covering is thin and you can see what's under the air in the area, then it's prohibited. It's not considered to be covering. And if the covering is tight, were you wearing tight pants, tight jeans, or whatever, so when you stand up, everybody can see your privates. You know, when you turn around, they can see your behind, etc. This is not considered covering in Islam. This is prohibited. Prayer in this kind of dress is not accepted, because it is a requirement for prayer in Islam that your privates be covered. So if you are going to wear pants, which are in any way tight wherein they will expose your privates, then you are obliged to wear a top which comes down and covers that area. This is why you find when you go around the Muslim world, where people have evolved the dress which involves pants and shirts, that always the top part will come down and cover this area. Or in other places, for example, where they may wear a top and a pants, you'll find they will wear a sarong, some small garment which will cover this area, looking sort of like a skirt. They will wear covering this area because it is a requirement of dress for males and Muslims, Muslim males, not to expose their privates. And I think this is an area which, you know, in the teaching of Islam to those who newly come to Islam, it is important for us to make this point clear. Because it is a neglected area. This is why women oftentimes feel, you know, this Islam is picking on us. All these things we have to do, but the men, they can do anything they want to do. But that's not so. There is a requirement for dress for males also. Oh, let me just add that, you know, the area, of course, for females, most people can understand why they need to cover from the shoulder down, right? But people have more difficulty in dealing with the hair. Now, the hair in the case of the woman and the hair in the case of the man, if we look to see who is in the beauty parlors, we see that it's not the men. I mean, in recent times, sure, you know, because of those people who are controlling the fashion. And when you look and meet those people who are involved in controlling, you know, fashions of dress, etc., you know, in the West, you go to France and meet these people, they're all homosexuals. You know, 90% of them are homosexuals. So what they're doing is they're trying to blur the difference between men and women. So they'll have men wearing dresses that are the same dresses that were normally worn by women, and women wearing dresses that were normally worn by men. So they'll get the men now starting to go to the beauty parlor and getting their hair done up in all these different ways, right? But traditionally, generally speaking in society, men just go and cut their hair. That's it. Women go and they get all these things done to it, it's blown up and it's flattered and all these kinds of things. In every society you go to, you see this is the way of the women. And their thoughts, their hair is their crowning glory. So, the hair is a means of attraction. So Islam says, fine, we understand, you can attract. But you should only attract those people whose attraction will be appreciated, will be acceptable. That is your husband, you know, your children, family. These people can appreciate your attraction, you know, compliment you on it, and it won't lead to anything which is harmful to you. But now when you go outside and you attract people who you are not married to, anybody on the street, they're attracted, then this is what now leads to rape, you know, and molestation of women, etc., etc. So Islam, for the protection of the female, it insists that she should also cover her hair. Question, why is it that Islam, or the Islamic religion, does not believe Jesus is the Son of God? Which was written in the book. The term Son of God has been used throughout the Bible in reference to most of the other prophets. In fact, Jesus even taught, as it's recorded in the Bible, the followers to pray, "Our Father." This is how it is recorded, "Our Father." In other words, we are all sons. So the question of sons, in the Hebrew language, in the Semitic language, indicated closeness to God and not begotten in that sense. The word begotten has been added to the Bible. Modern biblical scholars have pointed out that this term begotten is an inclusion. It was not in the original text. So, in fact, the teachings of Jesus was not that he was the Son of God. He's made it clear that the Father, God, was greater than he was. And he, in his own practice, worshipped God. He distinguished himself from God. So, Islam, which teaches the distinction between the Creator and his creation, which is based on the fundamental principle found in the Quran, "Laysa kamithlihi shay," there is nothing like him, wherein God in no way is like his creation. The creation has sons. God doesn't have a son. Because once you accept the idea that God can have a son, then the one who comes to you and says, "Well, God also has a father. And he has a grandfather and an uncle." Where are you going to stop? Why do you want to stop at son? Why not go all the way? You see? Once you open that door, you say God has a son. What in fact you are doing is you are taking God down from the level of creator and making him like his creation, having sons. So Islam keeps God on the level that he deserves to be kept, as the supreme being who is distinctly different from his creation. And as such, it does not recognize, based on the teachings, not human interpretations, but based on the teachings of the Quran, the last book of divine revelation, that God did not have a son. And Jesus is quoted in the Quran as saying, on the day of judgment, when he is asked why he told the people to worship him, he says that he did not tell the people to worship him, that this was what the people did after him. This was what people made up. This was what was attributed to Jesus. But Jesus, in fact, was a prophet of God who will, according to Islamic teachings, return as one of the signs of the last day. Islam believes, this is part of Islamic teachings, and it is required of Muslims to believe that Jesus, the prophet of God, Jesus, will come back to earth. He did not die. He will come back to earth as one of the signs of the last day. He will live out his life on the earth, marry, have children, and die on the earth. He will not bring a new revelation. The revelation is complete. He will be the leader of those who submit their wills to God on earth.
What are the criteria?
Question, what are the criteria in Islam which allows or permits man to marry more than one wife? Well, the fundamental criteria is that of justice. Being able to maintain justice between the wives. Being capable of maintaining the wives, if they, as a fundamental principle. Of course, if a wife wishes to maintain herself, that may be removed as a requirement, but as a fundamental requirement, it is there that he should be capable of maintaining those people who he marries. So if he is not able to maintain more than one wife, then he is not allowed to marry more than one wife. If he cannot deal justly with them, then he also is not allowed to marry more than one wife. This is a fundamental condition. Other than that, you know, people have, in time, in an attempt to try to make the plural marriage allowance in Islam seem more reasonable, they have said, well, you know, a man can only marry another wife if he doesn't have any children by his first wife. But this is not a condition. This is not a requirement. And as I said, human welfare is the fundamental principle which dictates the allowance for plural marriage. And it has nothing to do with having children or not having children. It may seem quite reasonable that if a person cannot have children by his first wife, it is a desire of each and every one of us to have children, that it may be reasonable in that circumstance for him to have another wife. But it is not a condition.
Could you please elaborate on the adoption, just in case people would think it's permissible?
The question or request to elaborate briefly on the principle of adoption in Islam, because I mentioned to you in the case of Usama ibn Zayd that his father was formerly an adopted son of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now, just in case you might think that Islam allows adoption, that in the initial stages adoption was allowed because it was a practice which existed amongst the Arabs, adoption, and Islam allowed it in the initial stages. But later, after the Islamic society was established and principles of inheritance and laws, etc., came into play, then the adoption, which involved the changing of the names of the people involved, was prohibited. That is, if by adoption you mean taking a child and raising that child and looking after the child, Islam confirms that. But if by adoption you mean taking a child and giving that child your name, Islam prohibits that. Because that child is not your child. The child retains its own name. Just as when you marry, you do not change the name of your wife. In Islam, when you marry, your wife keeps her own name. Because that name that she has indicates her family. When you marry her, does she become related to you in any way genealogically? She's a part of your cousin or your... No, she does not become a part of your family in that sense. She becomes a part of your family only to the degree that she is your wife. But if you, your family breaks up, if you divorce, she is not a related member of your family. No. So Islam does not allow the woman, when she marries, to change her name to the name of the husband. This practice came from Roman law. Among the Romans, all of their property was given their name. And the wife was considered a part of their property. So when they married, they gave her the name. Because the man had the free will to do anything he wanted with his wife. He wanted to kill her, maim her, do anything, he could do it. Because it was his property. Where in Islam, your wife is not considered your property. She is another individual human being who belongs to another family, who with whom you are cooperating in marriage. There are laws. You cannot do what you feel to do. There are laws which govern that relationship. And as such, she retains her own name. Similarly, you may take any child or any person, raise them in your family, look after them, do all the good you want for them. Even prescribe in your will a portion of your inheritance for them. You can do all that. But you may not change their name to your name. So that is what is prohibited. So that much of adoption is prohibited. But adoption in the sense of looking after somebody, that is confirmed by Islamic law.
Five more minutes.
Yeah.
Another question. One more question.
Yeah. Okay, I just got the sign which said that there's only 5 more minutes left. And there are a whole bunch of questions here. I will just be able to take one more question.
When you phone them.
No, well, I think it's already explained.
I'm trying to take over.
Okay. Question here. It says, Mr. Phillips, are you trying to convert us? Thank you. It is not possible for me to convert anybody. You may convert yourself. I can only try to point out to you what I believe to be true and give you whatever evidence I have gathered for that belief. But conversion is something which has to come from yourself. If you are convinced, then you may convert yourself by the will of God. So, unfortunately, in spite of the many questions that are here, because the program, you know, is set within certain bounds, we'll have to stop at this point. And I thank you for listening patiently and hope that whatever I have said has been of some benefit to you, and I ask you to remember me in your prayers. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.